So she was watching the TV. DVD is still playing.
Check the disc. A Thirst for Blood.
Oh.
This is the film Kate and I saw tonight.
Sounds like some trashy vampire film.
This is a classic of the late 1960s in which Stella Harris...
John, you're not going to believe this.
You're listening to Midsummer Murders Mayhem, the official podcast for the hit global television series Midsummer Murders. I'm your host, Nikki Chapman. In this podcast, I get to examine the Midsummer Murders television series in audio form, one nail-biting episode at a time. Spoiler alert, we leave no stone unturned, no evidence unchecked, no suspect unquestioned. So, if you haven't seen the episode in question, I suggest you do it right now. In this episode of Midsummer Murders Mayhem, we're going to be going to season 15, Death and the Divas. The murder of a journalist has chilling echoes of a 1960s horror film starring Midsummer's own Stella Harris. When Stella's more famous sister returns after a 40-year family rift, the killings escalate, each of them reminiscent of a movie plot. Is life and death imitating art? Helping me this week is award-winning Scottish comedian, actor, presenter, and most importantly, die-hard Midsummer Murders enthusiast, Ashley Story.
Juliet is not with her Romeo. She is with kind of the creepiest man in Midsummer. I don't know how he's getting all the ladies.
Coming up, we're going to be talking to Rachel Glaister from All3 Media International. If you're watching Midsummer Murders around the world, then they're the people responsible for getting it to your screens.
There are very, very few shows in England, Britain rather, that make it to 24 seasons. It's an incredibly rare feat.
Plus, we'll finish things off with a round of our Superfan Face-Off quiz, hosted by Ashley and featuring contestants from around the globe.
Can you check her buzzer, actually, to make sure that it's working?
You're quite right there, Diana. Anna, let's hear your buzzer to make sure it's working.
Woof, woof. That's all I got.
Also, be sure to stick around for the end where we tie up any of those loose ends, announce exactly who committed the murderous crimes, and how Barnaby solved them. So, Ashley, how are we today?
I am fantastic, and I'm so excited to talk about the death and the divas. How are you today, Nikki?
Well, I mean, which title shall we take? Should we be Death or shall we be Divas? I think I could do Divas quite well today.
It's freezing here in Scotland, so I'm as cold as Death, so I'll take Death.
So this is a great episode, isn't it? We always love anything theatrical.
Oh, it's such a good episode. And it's one of the few episodes of Midsummer Murders where the opening credits are a little bit different. They're all red and bloody to match the theme of the episode, which is all about 1960s Hammer horror films, that kind of age of sexy but spooky films. Did you like the Hammer horrors?
Well, I wasn't actually watching television in the 60s, but thank you for that. No, it wasn't really something that I grew up with, I can't lie.
I didn't think you were about then, Nikki. Maybe you had them on your, I don't know, your smartphone.
Look at that, good recovery. And I used to like you. No, but they were the sort of thing that my parents used to love and my grandparents loved them. And these were huge stars in their day.
Indeed. And this episode is all about two huge stars from that era, two sisters coming back together, played by Sinead Cusack and Harriet Walter. It's Stella Harris and Diana Davenport. They were starlets in that horror genre, walking about with their boobs hanging out and those, what are they called? A corset? No, a bodice.
Yes.
Getting bitten by vampires.
Yeah. Yeah, there's always a slight sort of sexual undertone, wasn't there? Perhaps it was just a reason they dressed it up to have sort of sexy scenes added to the films of the day.
Probably.
So, we should start off with the murder, shouldn't we?
Yeah, the first murder is just a lady sitting in her cottage. She's working on her laptop, she's watching the film, and then she's killed by somebody she knows. And that's where the episode starts. That's her first murder.
Yes. Now, she's found by her landlord, Patrick Tillman, who is a rather odd character straight away. And what we do find out really early on, that she was writing a book about local 1960s film star, the one and only Stella Harris, local girl, and her more famous sister, Diana Davenport, also an actress, but currently residing in America, but comes over to the UK.
Diana comes back from America with her husband, Cy, and they cause a stir because Midsummer's having a little horror festival. Barnaby's there with his wife, Sarah. He loves a horror film. He's a big fan of the genre and he's very excited when he gets to meet the sisters. I think this is one of the few times we see John Barnaby being a little bit starstruck. I don't think I've ever seen him blush before.
That's Diana Davenport.
It can't be. She's Hollywood royalty.
Yeah, but she's also Stella Harris's sister.
No, come on.
Yeah, he melts. The camera just holds, does it? It just pauses on him and he sort of... And he just takes that second too long while looking at her.
Just that little bit of uncomfortable length in his gaze at the Davenport lady. I also enjoy how whenever they have a film star in TV shows, they have to be wearing something sparkly so that we know that's the film star.
Like you need a big arrow above. But this dynamic between the two sisters, it's a long-running feud, isn't it? It goes back 40 years or so.
Yeah, and it's all to do with work because Stella knows Diana stole a part from her. Cy took a part away from her and gave it to Diana, and she's held a grudge for a really long time. Now, there's more layers to this.
Well, I didn't realise until quite well into this that Stella actually used to work with Cy, didn't she?
Mm-hmm. He was the big Hollywood producer. And it's a shame. It's a fickle business, a show business. It's not an easy game. But I'm going to say now, for a woman whose career got taken away from her, she lives in possibly the most luxurious cottage I've ever seen in Midsummer Murders. I don't know if you remember it, Nikki, but it was one of the most stunning cottages I've ever seen in my entire life. It looked about a three-story, had so much thatch. That must cost so much just to upkeep that thatchy roof.
Honestly, when you're watching the show, you're looking at these beautiful properties, these houses, gorgeous with this thatch. And if you go to any major town or city in the UK, you're not going to see a thatch, let's be honest. But they look stunning.
Thatch is lovely, but it can't stop murder.
No. And did we mention that Eve Lomax, the writer, when she was found, about these pinpricks on her neck, like Dracula, because she was watching the movie. And then when Barnaby and Jones turn up, they see she's got two pricks in her neck.
Yep, that's right. She's got two little holes equidistant apart on her neck.
Can I just ask a question here, Ashley? Why yep. would you die from two holes on your neck? It's a minor thing, but there's not much blood. And why would that kill you?
I think your carotid artery's up there. I don't know because I'm not a pathologist, but I have watched a lot of crime shows and I'm thinking that there's probably like a main artery and if you hit it right, then you're a goner. I'm assuming that's why vampires go for the neck, though I've never met one. I've also never seen a thatched roof in real life, so those
have
are just
not?
As imaginary as vampires. No, I've never seen one.
Keep watching Midsummer Murders, you won't be disappointed. There'll be one popping up every week, promise you. So we've decided then that Eve Lomax, she bled to death as a result of these mm-hmm. puncture wounds on her neck, much like some of the characters in one of Stella Harris's old films. So this is where it gets really, really interesting. And Stella's daughter Emma knew Lomax from the days from school, and there was a little bit of a relationship there, like a friendly relationship, and it later transpires that she's been chatting to her about her mother and her aunt.
That's right. She's writing a book about her mother and her aunt and about those divas back in the day. And maybe she's uncovered something that she should have left well alone.
Yes. Because Emma, when she sees her aunt, that she maintains she's never met her before, she was truly unimpressed. However, her daughter, Rosie, who's much obviously younger, idolises her aunt.
Yeah, it's a great aunt. But we're also forgetting that there's Scott is in the mix, who is Diana Davenport's son, the American, who's come over to live in the UK with his other family because he doesn't want to be part of the Hollywood machine anymore. He wants to be a gardener in Midsummer. And Diana and Cy are trying to lure him back to America.
Oh, my baby.
Hey, Dad. Thought you could outrun your old man, huh? Give me some credit.
took you a year.
Now, boys, greetings, children of the night.
Honestly, she's so relaxed about it as a mother. She can see that the son and the father absolutely hate each other. And Anna Davenport's like, yes, boys, just get on with it. It's fine. She's so relaxed. It's all about her. She's the star.
She does not give a fig. She is completely happy. I think it's just that Hollywood vibe. I think once you've lived there too long, you stop caring about stuff. I don't know what it is, but she's very laissez-faire about the whole situation. If I had, now I only have a dog, so I don't know what it's like to be a parent, but if my dog tried to bite my dad, I'd be terribly worried. I'd be like, that's your granddad. Don't be aggressive to him.
And I'm just going to say, Ashley, because we love the Britishisms or the Scottishisms that come up, and you've just given us one. She doesn't give a fig. That's a great line. That's you.
It was me censoring myself and making sure I don't do any effing and jeffing on the podcast.
There you go. So where did we get to then? So we can see that the family are really, really not happy. We know that Eve Lomax was writing a book to reveal all between these two sisters that absolutely hated each other. And there is that wonderful moment when Diana goes to have a look and knocks on the door of Stella and tries to make peace with her.
I know you're in there. Open up. I'm not leaving until you let me in. God knows things haven't always been easy between us. We've both done and said things we shouldn't. Hateful things. But you're my sister and I love you. I've dreamt of coming back here for months, years
even.
And now that dream is in ruins.
Because you can't forgive me.
I laugh divided. One can see why you didn't win the Oscar.
I was robbed.
I think it's very telling in that clip that Diana doesn't know how to communicate with her sister unless it's from a script she's already previously done. I think that that's very telling of their relationship, that they can only communicate through the lines of films that they've been in.
It's sort of like, it's a joke, isn't it? She's standing outside and the other one's behind the door, just hiding, thinking, shall I let her in or not? Shall I let her in? And then they, as you say, they go into character, still hating each other after 40 years.
Now, Diana, when she comes back, this is one for all those Midsummer mega fans. When Diana comes back, she rents a house, Langley Hall. And you might be sitting there thinking, that house looks suspiciously familiar. And that is because this is the third time it has appeared in Midsummer Murders. It was in one of my favourite episodes, A Talent for Life, with Honor Blackman. You might recognise those bright yellow hall walls where we had Honor Blackman's character's funeral. It's kind of one of those stately homes. It's technically called Adwell House, but it's one of those stately homes that the Midsummer crew love filming in because it's such a old-fashioned, fun building with a lot of bright colours. And it does have that gaudy sort of glamorous new money feel to it, but in the
beautiful
old school
house
British mansion feel. I think it's those bright yellow walls. There's something a bit Jane Austen about it that I love.
A good spot there, a really good spot. So we've really got to talk about this party, because things take a turn, don't they, Ashley?
Oh, they go so wrong at this party. They have a party with some of their Midsummer friends to welcome Diana back. And Diana's really excited to be home. This is her birthplace. This is where she grew up. And she wants to come back there and stay there to be near her sister. And also, it's kind of fun, I think, to be a big fish in a little pond rather than a medium fish in a huge pond. So I'm sure she'd get a lot of attention in Midsummer. But Cy's not keen on it. But they have this big party nonetheless. And what we learn about Cy in this party is that he likes to make a grand entrance because he used to be a stuntman. So he likes to throw himself off of things to frighten his guests. So when Cy starts screaming and calling for help, everybody thinks, oh, it's just that big attention seeker. And they don't realise it's because he's actually been murdered.
Da, 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 with a thud. With a thud. And what's interesting is the house that they have rented, they've rented it off Patrick Tillman. So Patrick Tillman is Eve's landlord and he finds Eve dead. Patrick Tillman has also rented out a house to Diana Davenport and Cy, and he's hoping to sell it. So that's his side of the business. And he's got a little bit of an eye for the ladies. But what we find out very early on, that his relationship with his wife, it's not great, is it, with Juliet?
No, Juliet is not with her Romeo. she is with kind of the creepiest man in Midsummer. I don't know how he's getting all the ladies because he's distinctly odd, but he somehow has a way with them. I don't know. Maybe he's just got like a sexy walk. I don't know what it is he's doing that's luring them in. But Juliet owns some form of an organic vegetable delivery service, which Emma works for and
yes.
Scott works for. So the Davenport's son and Stella Harris's daughter, who are cousins, work for the vegetable delivery company, which also hires Perry.
Perry Stevens is the delivery driver who is sleeping when he's got the energy with Emma, because we have to have sex in nearly every scene. He then isn't able to make Emma happy, shall we say, in the bedroom department because he is so exhausted. And you're thinking, okay, well, why is that? And then we find out because he's not just delivering vegetables. Oh, no. Young Perry Stevens Mm-mm. is delivering with added extras.
He's delivering the meat as well.
And the money that he's making off these awful earnings is also going to Juliet, who is Patrick's wife, the landlord. You still with us? Yes. And this drives Jones mad because he gets an inkling. He follows him and he's like, well, he's not just delivering the veg. He was a long time in that house. And then when he sees one of the ladies open the door in a negligee, then the penny drops for Jones.
He looks through the window at Perry Stevens mid-coitus.
Just Jones, too much for me, these sex scenes.
Perry is a gigolo vegetable delivery man. He doesn't discriminate gender. He's not just having it away with the ladies of the village. He has also been satisfying some of the men of Midsummer too. And poor Emma, his girlfriend, I don't think she has any idea that this is why he's so tired at night.
Help me get undressed.
Sorry, babe, I'm really knackered.
You're always tired.
Yeah, it's because I work hard.
But what really makes me laugh is Jones's face where he follows the delivery man who is delivering vegetables mm-hmm. to Sarah Barnaby. Yeah. And he looks yep. shocked because he's like, uh-oh. And the delivery man goes in and closes the door.
What are we having?
We are having a vegetable tagine.
Oh, organic ingredients, I trust?
Yes, as it happens. I signed us up to a new delivery service, Warden Organics. It's all good local stuff and they're very obliging.
And were you in when this lot arrived?
Yeah, I just got back. Actually, it was rather a dishy delivery man.
Really? And did the dishy and obliging delivery man offer you any optional extras?
Come on, John, spit it out.
Vegetables with added spice, you might say. And I'm not talking about fresh chilies and hand-ground cumin seeds.
You're joking.
Scout's Honour, Jones has been doing some undercover surveillance.
Well, what a swizz. All I got was a bunch of carrots, four beetroots and a cabbage.
Oh, you must let me make it up to you.
Sarah says, what a swizz. I've never heard that before. Is that an Englishism or is that just a Sarah-ism?
No, it's definitely an Englishism. A swizz, being cheated. You've been swizzed out of something. So you'd think of it like if you were gambling, he swizzed me out, or you lost your car or your home or perhaps your wife. He swizzed me out of it, or she swizzed me out of it. She did me in. She got me on that one.
I've never heard that before.
Isn't that funny? Those words that you take for granted and other people have never heard them at all. So we know the writer Eve has died. Cy has been stabbed and literally throws himself down the banisters onto the floor. But there's a third death as well, isn't there?
Yes. Colin Yule gets murdered again in the style of the Hammer horror films that Stella starred in. He is mummified and wrapped in bandages and left in his flat. I will say John Barnaby interferes with the scene of crime. He pulls off the mask and pulls bandages from the victim's mouth, which he shouldn't do as a police officer. He should leave well alone. But he wanted to check he was dead.
And they don't often wear gloves as well.
That they never wear gloves, smile. Nikki.
I know. Fingerprints everywhere. But hey. So we've got three deaths all in the style of a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
But why? Why is this happening? And who is the murderer?
This is a star-studded episode, Nikki. We've got Harriet Walter playing Diana Davenport, and you might recognise her from the hugely successful Succession. Were you a fan of that show?
I watched the first two series and then I gave up on it. So she's in that, is she?
She's in Succession. She's in Ted Lasso. She was in Doctor Who. She's been in Sense and Sensibility as Fanny Dashwood, which is one of my favourite character names. She was in The Young Victoria. She was in The Last Duel, which was a phenomenal film and I think underrated. It came out at a bad time. I don't know why more people didn't watch it. I think it's a cracking film. She was in The Force Awakens, a Star Wars film. She has been all over the Earth screens for years. There was actually a little special appearance by Caroline Munro. Now, she was playing a character in one of the films from the olden days that the sisters were in, and she was actually one of those busty ladies, was our Caroline Munro, who featured in those films. She was in The Adventures of Sinbad. She was in The Spy Who Loved Me. She was an original Bond girl. She is genuinely one of those vampire ladies from those days, which is so cool to get somebody who was actually part of that film movement in this episode about that time in film. And Perry, our vegetable delivery man, he is a very handsome actor.
Very.
Played by Samuel Anderson.
Didn't say much, though, did he?
Mm-mm. But he didn't need to.
He spoke in other ways.
He was in one of my favourite British films, The History Boys.
Was he?
He was one of the boys of history.
Well,
but
on this, he was just the delivery driver with extras and he had to look sultry, didn't he, and sexy at all times and just sort of grunted every time he was questioned.
Well, he nailed it. Well done, sir.
Now, Cy Davenport, Diana's husband and the film producer, he looks so familiar. And I have been racking my brains to think, where have I seen him before?
He is an actor called Henry Goodman. Now, he was in Yes, Minister. He is also part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I don't know if you're a big fan of that, Nikki. But he plays Dr. List. He was in Avengers Age of Ultron and he was in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is a television programme which is part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He's been in so much, it would be hard to go through. Like, his acting credits alone, 109 listed appearances as an actor. So he is he's a workhorse.
He is, yeah. He deserves to be in Midsummer Murders. He's earned his place.
Indeed.
In this episode of Midsummer Murders Mayhem, we're going to be speaking to Rachel Glaister, who is EVP, Executive Vice President of All3 Media International. So, if you've ever met the cast and crew when they've been doing a tour in your country, then you know what? You can thank her. So, Rachel, we are so delighted you can join us today because, well, we're hoping you are going to unlock some secrets of this super, super popular drama.
I have some behind the scenes intel for you, Phil.
I love this. I love this. So tell us, first of all, a little bit about your role at All3 Media International. I mean, and really, how you've so successfully marketed a British murder series around the world. And I'm just going to put it out there, to 200 territories. Yes, 200.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? And some people dispute if there are 200 territories, but I can tell you that there are. It's not the same as countries. It's a kind of one of our jargons, because territories are tied to languages and the like. But Midsummer has been the largest detective drama export for well over a decade, actually. The industry used to measure, it stopped doing so about 15 years ago, so we ended on a high, but the show has continued to grow, and it's on air at any one time, we think, in about 180 countries at any one point, which is phenomenal. And the world indeed does love Midsummer. And I think what they love about it is they're identifiable and comfortable tropes. So it's always very amusing that everyone thinks Midsummer's very genteel, don't they? And it's a kind of a comfortable put your slippers on watch.
Yes.
But actually, it's one of the most violent things on television. And you've been talking about Death and Divas, which I think is a really fabulous example of the show, and it kind of has all the tropes which I know all of the fans around the world adore, and the kind of quintessential Midsummer, in the sense that you've got the manor house,
yes,
and for good or bad, Midsommar does like to reflect times of serfdom.
Yes.
And you can get quite a lot of nice class warfare in. And we're still very good at that.
Yeah.
And other countries seem to respect us all, or are certainly amused by it anyway. We have family feuds.
Yeah.
And obviously we all know a family feud is the best precinct for a murder. So watch out for your family. And if you can throw in warring siblings and dubious parentage, then you're on for a classic ep, I think.
Definitely.
Then we have brilliant casting. And this is a really key thing for Midsommar. It's attracted over its tenure the best in theatre and stage talent. And those brilliant actors, who you may not know their name, but you know they did a brilliant performance in at least 10 other things that you've seen. And that plays very well internationally. They really respect British actors and their craft. Then we've got a good, strong theme, or, as is in the case of many episodes, a hobby. And again, that's a brilliant springboard for a plot. So in this one, obviously, we've got the kind of the Midsommar Langley horror movie club. And then as an added thing, and this definitely is a key trope, a gorgeous location. I think this one was actually filmed in Littlewick Green. And we know that people adore this kind of beautiful part of England and those soft rolling hills of the Chiltern that do exist.
Yes.
But I can tell you from going on set many times, they exist with the noise of the M25, the M40 and the M4 and planes landing at Heathrow and Luton. But it does,
yeah, we don't want
you
to think about some of the UK's busiest motorways only being 3 miles down the road, do we? We don't need to hear that. But it locations are so beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And they are genuine properties, aren't they? It's not staged in any way.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, and this can be a bit of an issue, actually, with fans, in the nicest possible way, to be honest, because they are all private residences, generally. And so when they go to a village, there's a lot of approvals with the locals that has to go on. And then they'll try and make as little impact into daily life as possible, because it is very irritating when your roads get shut and things like that and you can't get to school. So they'll use certain homes and they'll use three angles. So there'll be the back of the house, which could be one location, the side and the front. So they'll absolutely maximise their time in any one location and hope not to cause chaos.
Well, you mentioned the fans. How important are the fans to Midsommar Murders, to the team?
Oh, it's everything. I mean, there are very, very few shows in England, Britain rather, that make it to 24 seasons. It's an incredibly rare feat. And to also hold such warmth in people's hearts, there's one dog. It's not like it's kind of full of cute animals. It's actually, as I said, quite a violent show. So you've got a detective who's reassuring in some ways. And I remember when I first met John Nettles, he explained to me very clearly, because he's very clever, that it's actually a costume drama. It's a comedy of manners, effectively, which harks back to other theatrical tropes such as restoration comedy. So whilst it looks very normal, everyone is playing a type, and it's comforting because of that type. And the fact that all of our inspectors have 100% clear-up rate is very, very reassuring, because you can go to bed knowing that there's no crime left.
We love that. Besides, I've got to ask you, when you go walkabouts with the cast and the crew in different countries, you know, what's it like? Does everybody want to have a piece? Do they all want the funny tales?
You do get a lot of questions kind of going, oh, we're surprised you're still alive because you live in Midsommar. That does seem to be the recurring, not quite a surprise question. But I have to say, John Neal and the other cast who often kind of journey with us are so generous with their time and generous with their spirit. And they accommodate meeting so many people, do meet and greets very happily. And they just embrace what the show means to people. And they're aware it's very important in some people's lives. And that it's a very comforting, reliable... Television is important to a lot of people.
Yes.
And a show that kind of has that nice closed 2 hour or 90 minutes kind of scenario where you can play them out of order and you can kind of catch up. You don't have to watch 8 episodes or something. You can just kind of watch it when you're in the mood and find it in various places. That has a very important role to play, I think, for fans. So, yes, they've been very good. We've been to many countries, actually. When we started to discuss doing these tours, I did want to make sure that it didn't seem just like homework to them. It had to be fun to them as well, because, you know, they do have a life outside of Midsummer. So we kind of made certain pledges or decided what each would like. And they're both football fans. But John is possibly more of a theatre fan. I mean, John's pedigree is RSC. Neil did a bit of Royal Court, but he's happier kind of on television and film, I think. So with John, we decided that we'd always try and go to a country with a good opera house.
Oh, nice.
And Neil is fabulously smart on contemporary art. So with him, we had to have a very good art gallery. And it's quite funny, in a couple of countries, we've ended up with, when we were doing local TV, which is also national TV, so in Germany and I think in Holland it was as well, we've ended up with Neil actually going curating round an art gallery with a news crew, and he can totally hold his own. He's super smart on all of that.
Living in the UK, there is a sense of pride when you think, gosh, 24 series are going around the world and that people are loving it and appreciating it as much as we do here. It's great. What an export.
It's fabulous. And I think it kind of goes, you know, as far as, you know, in Japan. Every now and then we record idents for our client broadcasters. You know, when you kind of see in between programs another show being promoted and you have some of the cast kind of saying, coming soon to this channel. We've recently done a batch of those 19 countries asked, which means 19 countries are about to broadcast. And we had everyone from Latvia to Lithuania to Japan to Portugal to America. And Germany, we did this hilarious sketch actually for Germany. But yes, you're right. The houses, well, you know a lot about houses. The houses are charming, and the houses in the landscape is a killer combination, isn't it?
And I'm just going to say, Midsummer, as a county, it hardly ever rains. So for everybody out there around the globe, you see, the UK, it doesn't rain every single day. Just believe the weather on Midsummer Murders and you'll sort of be close to the truth. Do you know what, Rachel? This actually is an audition for you to be one of our super fans, and you have definitely, definitely passed. Definitely.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Nikki. Well, I'm glad the podcast is going so well, and I am sure the fans will love it.
Well, thank you so much. And you have to promise us one thing. Are you ready?
And that is?
That you keep making so many more shows for us all to enjoy.
We're going to do our best.
Wonderful.
Welcome to your favourite part of the show. It's the Superfan head-to-head face-off mega quiz with me, Ashley Story. And I am joined with Anna, who's originally from the country Georgia, but currently resides in Chicago. Hello, Anna.
Hi.
And Diana, who is in Houston, Texas. Hello, Diana.
Hello.
Welcome to the quiz, ladies. Are you big Midsummer Murder fans?
Most definitely.
Okay, here at the head-to-head Super Face-Off fandom quiz, we can't afford buzzers, so you have to make your own buzzer sound. Anna, what is your buzzer sound going to be?
My buzzer sound will be barking dog.
Amazing. Anna will be barking. Diana, what's your buzzer sound going to be? Just so you know, you can't bark like a dog, because Anna has called dibs on that.
What if I'm a different dog? I mean, I can be a bigger dog. Whoa.
It isn't that kind of quiz.
I'll do a trill.
Ooh, Diana. Diana trilling away. Okay, ladies, we've got a dog, we've got a trill, we've got questions. Are you ready?
Ready or not?
I think so.
Okay, here we Midsummer go. Question number one. This episode centres on a film society festival in which village? Diana, you trilled first. What's your answer, please?
Midsummer Langley?
Ooh, 1 point to Diana. We're off to the races. Question number two. Which iconic British actress portrays the Hollywood star Diana Davenport?
Olivia de Havilland.
It is not, but you did ask to hear my buzzer sound, and my buzzer sound would be... That would be my...
That was brilliant.
Well, thank you. It's a talent that has really no purpose in life, but I try and shoehorn it into any situation. The correct answer was Dame Harriet Walter. 1 point to Ashley. Question number three. Diana Davenport is renting which Midsummer property on her return to the area? Oh, Diana?
The manor house work, or do I actually have to give the name of the house?
I need a name of the house. Anna?
Eve's house?
It is not. You're going to kick yourself, ladies, because the village is Midsummer Langley and the hall is Langley Hall. 2 points to Ashley. Question number 4. This episode marked an anniversary for Jason Hughes in his Midsummer career. How many episodes had he appeared in? Diana.
50.
It is 50. Well done. Question number 5. Cy Davenport produced the Stella Harris film Death and the Diva and also played the role of which character? Oh, Diana's in again. We haven't even got to hear Anna Bark.
I know.
Diana, what's your answer?
The monster.
He played the monster. Bang on the money, friend. Okay, question number 6, Anna.
All right.
Get yourself ready.
All right. I can do this.
I'll check her buzzer, actually, to make sure that it's working.
You're quite right there, Diana. Anna, let's hear your buzzer to make sure it's working.
Woof, woof.
That's all I got.
Okay. Question 6. How long had Diana and Cy Davenport been away from Midsummer before returning?
Woof, woof.
Anna?
20 years?
Incorrect. Diana, would you like to try and sweep in and steal it?
25?
Oh, incorrect on both counts, ladies. It was 40 years.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
Another point to Ashley. This could be a round she wins. Oh, my goodness. Question number 7. When searching Colin Yule's house, Jones finds what item of Diana Davenport's in a box? Yes, Diana?
Her knickers?
It is!
Can we say that here?
Yes, you can. He finds her silk knickers. Question number 8. The Stella Harris film that inspired Colin Yule's death was called what? Yes, Diana.
One Mummy.
Diana, you get the point because you were closest. It's The Mummy Rises. Okay, question number 9. Barnaby deduces that Diana, not Stella, is Emma's mother from what piece of evidence?
Woof woof.
Yes, Anna.
Is it from watching the old films?
No, but I'm so glad we waited to hear you whiff again. Diana, would you like to hazard a guess?
It's the slave woman photo from 1970, which shows a very svelte Stella.
That is exactly the answer. It's a photograph from 1970. Question number 10. After Barnaby is proven right about the murders being inspired by the films, name one of the movies Jones suggests he watch instead. Jones suggests some more modern films.
What's really funny is the first one that comes to my mind is like Close Encounters, but I don't think that's it.
It's not Close Encounters, I'm afraid, which is a great film about a woman who gets a bit of grit in her eye and then, no, that's Brief Encounters. Close Encounters is about aliens, never mind. The answers were The Matrix and Top Gun. Which means the scores at the end of that round are Diana with 6 points, Anna with 0 points, and Ashley with 4 whole points. Well done, me. Well done, guys. As much as you struggled, Anna, it was fun to have you. I enjoyed your marking.
Thank you.
You did contribute a lot of laughs to this episode, and I appreciate you for that. Diana, your knowledge of Midsummer. Whew, that's some good knowledge you've got there, lady. Thank you so much.
Now, as you may know, at the end we like to wrap it all up so we can finally answer that question, who done it?
Well, it's one of 3 reasons. It's revenge, it's money, or it's sex. I think this one falls under the revenge category. It is, shockingly, it is Emma who has been committing these crimes on who she knows isn't her mother, but loves nonetheless as her mother's behalf. Because yes, Stella is not Emma's mother. Diana Davenport is, in fact, Emma's mother. Spoiler alert. And she has been raised by Stella at the behest of her grandmother, who was, I guess, like the Kris Jenner of her day. She's a stage mom. She's a momager. She's the type of mother who wants her daughters to be more famous than anything in the world. And in a bid to keep Diana Davenport out of the bad books for getting pregnant out of wedlock, because it was the olden days, she encouraged Stella to raise the child as her own because Stella already had a husband. And as it transpired, she couldn't have kids. So she was happy to be a mum and she was grateful that she got this opportunity to raise this child. But Emma did not cope with the wrong that was done to Stella.
I grew up hating Diana for taking that away from her.
Hate is a waste of time, Emma. I think Stella realises that now.
What do you mean?
You've seen Stella and Diana together. Whatever happened 40 years ago, they're still sisters. Maybe in the end, that is what is really important. Family.
And Emma found out from Eve when she was researching her book about her mother and her aunt. And it just absolutely blew her mind.
Eve Lomax warned you that she was going to publish her scoop, that Diana was your real mother. But you couldn't allow that, could you?
And then sadly, Colin Yule, the Film Society president, also clicked something had gone on. So Emma had to get rid of him because in her mind, she didn't want anybody to know that Diana Davenport was her true mother.
So when Colin Yule announced that he was taking over the book, you had to kill him too. And destroy that photo.
That ruthless bitch may have given birth to me, but she is not my mother.
And she had to get rid of Cy because he had done her mother wrong.
And Cy Davenport, you killed him because he gave Diana a part in a film?
It was the worst kind of betrayal, and Mummy never got over it.
You told me that your mother never talked to you about the past.
She put on a brave face, but whenever she was drunk or depressed, it all came out. Acting was part of who she was. And without it, she didn't feel whole.
And the thing is, this is all circled around a photograph, Nikki. A photograph of Stella in a bikini in the 60s when Emma was supposed to be in her mummy's tummy. And the thing is, those photos aren't dated, really. You could lie really easily and say, oh no, that's a mistake. That picture was taken in 1967. Just ignore the writing on the back. The person wrote a mistake. But somehow it became key evidence. It wouldn't stand up in court. I'm just saying.
Do you know what? When I was a young girl growing up, photographs did used to have the dates on them. Because we used to take the old-fashioned photographs and they always had the date. Emma then decides to kidnap her real mother and take her to the crypt to reenact a final murder, like a scene from a horror movie.
But that's not before she tries to fake her own death by cutting her brake lines. And it's one of my least favourite film tropes because it assumes that nobody's had to use their brakes before the crash. And I'm sure every driver knows that when you're like pulling out of your parking space, you use your brake. But it was one of the ways that Stella had died in her previous film. So it stuck with the theme of this Midsummer episode where she was reenacting deaths from the films that her mum and her aunt had starred in.
You have to get down there. She's killed three people already and she tried to kill me.
Nobody tried to kill you.
Someone's ever done my brakes.
Yes, you.
So thanks to this photograph that has been somehow dated, Nikki, Barnaby solves the crime and he works out that the killer is in fact Emma and he runs back to Langley Hall and the crypt that is beside it to stop her from killing anybody else. And here, even though Emma's trying to protest that she was the victim, he knows the truth and he gets to the bottom of it.
Press down hard.
The door's locked and I can't find the key. Where's the key, Emma? The key! Oh, come on.
Next time on Midsummer Murders Mayhem, Bill and I'll be delving into the hidden depths of Blue Herrings, which is the first episode to not have an actual murder in it. There is a mercy killing, but whether that counts as a murder is open for discussion.
Tom, there's something that frightens me.
What's that?
I lent her my shawl, Madge. Well, she was wearing it when she died. Suppose, just suppose, whoever did it thought he was killing me.
We'll hear from the wonderfully talented composer Jim Parker.
But I thought a waltz was a good idea, and one that, slightly unpredictable, the theremin.
As well as Frank Ballack from ZTF Television, who's been broadcasting the show for the past 25 years in Germany.
As long as your writers find new ways of killing someone in a very special, unique way, there will be fans who would like to watch it.
And of course, we'll round things off nicely with Ashley Story's Superfan Face-Off. Midsummer Murders Mayhem is presented by me, Nikki Chapman. A massive thank you to Ashley Story and to our guest, Rachel Glaister. This has been an All Three Media International production, with special thanks to associate producers Rachel Glaister and Gary Wolf. This series was created by Story Hunter. The executive producer was Kirsty Hunter, produced by Shannon Delwish. The production team was Pam Muir, Ellie Abraham, and Reham Musa.